Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on vacation. July has become the deadliest month for U.S. forces in the nine-year Afghan war after three U.S. service members were killed yesterday. Russia's president signs a law giving greater power to the agency that succeeded the KGB. Critics fear the law will be used to intimidate opponents. And North Korea and the U.S. led UN command meet for a third time over the sinking of a South Korean warship last spring. Joining me in the studio to discuss the week's top international stories on our Friday News Roundup, David Sanger of the New York Times, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, and Kevin Whitelaw of Congressional Quarterly. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
We're going to invite our listeners to give us a call. Our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. We'll take some of your comments and questions later in the hour. You can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org, or you can find us on Twitter or Facebook. We had Robert Gibbs, the White House press secretary, on the Today Show this morning on NBC, imploring WikiLeaks not to post more of those documents from the Afghan war. What is the White House concern here, Nancy?
Well, WikiLeaks has said that it has an additional 15,000 documents that have yet to be published. These documents are believed to be State Department cables and to be a little bit more detailed and some would argue damaging than the 75,000 that have already come out. And I think the real concern is in the 75,000 that have been released so far, there are names of Afghan informants and families who have come forward who have done things as innocuous as handing over weapons to providing useful tips to American soldiers. The Taliban has said, through their spokesman, that they're going through those documents now, and there's a real worry that those Afghans will be killed for working with the allies. And the reality is the United States doesn't have the resources to protect these Afghans who are living in remote villages and parts where we might not have the resources to give them the kind of protection that they need.
Kevin, these documents have been posted just for 5 or 6 days. Do we know how much damage or what kind of peril they've caused on the ground in Afghanistan already, or what the potential is?
Well, I think, quite honestly, everyone's still, you know, trying to go through them, including the military, to figure out what's in them. But even they, you know, are looking at that size and saying, we don't have the manpower, we don't have the time, we don't, you know, really have the ability to go through it. And even if we were, you know, as Nancy said, even if we, you know, identified all the various names of people, you know, there's not all that much we can do. So I think the concern is both in the immediate, perhaps retribution sense, but there's also a larger doubt that it instills among other Afghans who might, you know, down the line have thought about helping out U.S. forces in terms of giving information, in terms of talking about insurgents, you know, in their neighborhoods, who looking at this release, you know, hearing about it, understanding that it's out there, wonder whether U.S. forces will be able to protect them if they choose to give that information. So there is that concern operationally on the ground.
David Sanger, your newspaper got an early look at these documents, did a big story about it in Monday's paper. Do they tell us anything we didn't know before?
Before we get to that, let me just distinguish between what we published and what you're hearing here. The Times did get an early look at this, along with The Guardian in England and Der Spiegel. And as we went through them, we were very careful not to include in any of the material that we published or any of the material we linked to any of the names, operational information, things that would do exactly what we're concerned about here. We don't have any control over what WikiLeaks, which had gotten this material originally, does. We've urged them not to go reveal information that could get people killed or hunted after by the Taliban or others. I think what these documents did was give a ground-level view of some tensions that we knew about for a long time. We knew, for example, that the ISI, the Pakistani Security Service, Intelligence Service, was suspected of aiding Taliban attacks. It's one thing to sort of know that in theory, and it's another thing to see specific attacks reported back about, and these were essentially sort of the equivalent of police reports, with the suspicions, unfiltered, sometimes unproven, of Americans on the ground that there was ISI participation.
You know, it was like reading a police blotter, some of these reports. So, Nancy, what was the reaction from Pakistani authorities to this portrait of Pakistani officials in the military spy service really playing a double game?
Well, they were outraged, just outraged. And we heard that from some of the key members, Lieutenant General Hamid Ghul, who was the head of the ISI from 1987 to 1989, who was charged in these documents of working alongside the Taliban, even going to madrasas and recruiting members, dismissed any suggestion of it. The Pakistanis have insisted that they've been actually working much more aggressively to go after the Taliban and other extremist groups in their country, and that these documents were old and go back to only to December 2009. And since then, they've become much more aggressive because they too recognize the Taliban threat. Now, that's what happened publicly. I think privately, it was the same reaction that we've all had, that there wasn't anything. There wasn't a smoking. I mean, there were a lot of details in this, but I think, as The Guardian pointed out, there was no smoking gun linking the ISI to training Taliban fighters in Afghanistan. And so that was a little bit of wiggle room. I thought what was interesting was the Afghan reaction, particularly in the Afghan streets, because they pointed to these documents, those who were aware of them, and said, "You see, we're caught in this middle. We're in the middle. We're the real victims in all this. We've been telling you all along that they've been playing a double game, and there you go. Now you can see for yourself."
Kevin.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think the you definitely get this impressionistic sense of there must be something going on. Where there's smoke, there's fire, from reading the level of involvement there. But, you know, both U.S. officials and Pakistanis and others said, you know, this has changed. And a lot of the portrait that was painted over that time, U.S. officials say, is part of the reason that they work to revamp the strategy, change direction, and do a lot of things. Pakistan has stepped up its efforts against militants. It has changed its tune to some degree when it comes to these activities. We don't know how much, of course. That's very much a matter of scrutiny at the highest levels of the government. So, you know, this is a snapshot. It's a snapshot in time. Things have changed slightly, but at the same time, it presents a muddled picture when you have so many different reports at the ground level. What it was lacking was that sort of sifting all through it, and those documents that then said, okay, here's what we take from all of this. Here's what we believe is actually confirmable. Here's what we don't believe is true. That's what makes it in the end a little difficult to evaluate.
And of course, it's one of the things that makes it different from the Pentagon papers published in 1971, which was more of a comprehensive report that had been pulled together by experts. Do you think there is a comparison, David, in your paper, The New York Times, published the Pentagon papers in 1971? Is this the version for this war of the Pentagon papers?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, the comparison is, because of the way they were disclosed, is an easy one to make. But the Pentagon Papers, as you suggest, was actually a history of the war written by professionals who had sifted through a fair bit of evidence, cut out the stuff they didn't believe, cut out the early reports, and basically gave a very high-level view. This was a series of uncorroborated but fascinating individual reports. Some of them weren't even full sentences. They're just, you know, reports from the fields. They're almost like looking at a police officer's notebook. And, you know, there are assumptions made in it that some of them, I'm sure, are right and some of them are wrong. On Pakistan's double game, you know, we had reports 2 or 3 years ago under the Bush administration of the head of the director of national intelligence going to Pakistan in 2008 and basically being told by Pakistani two-star generals that they were supporting the Taliban even while supporting the United States because they feared the U.S. was going to leave. And, you know, this is what's brought about this impression that Pakistan is our great ally on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and not on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
You know, one of the things that strikes me in comparing these two cases is how the technology has transformed everything. In the Pentagon Papers case, a big court battle to keep it from being published. In this case, not even really an effort to pull these down from WikiLeaks, available to anybody who's got a modem to look at.
Yeah, and it's, you know, just so you know, these are a lot of these reports were what the military calls IIR, which are initial intelligence reports, and they're really the first reports that we're seeing on any incident. What I find interesting in all this, one of the key suspects of the leak is a private by the name of Bradley Manning, who has said that he leaked 280,000 documents to WikiLeaks, that he did it while humming Lady Gaga's telephone as an intelligence officer at Fort from the 10th Mountain Division, stationed in Baghdad. And what's interesting, and Secretary Gates brought this up yesterday, the reason these guys at such low levels have access to these documents was a result of the Gulf War and the feeling that you needed to get as much intelligence to as low level as possible, and that it really was accelerated under Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think because of the technology that you speak about, we're now seeing the military really reassess and say, do we really need to give that much access? If it was Manning, he had access to documents about a war he was not even fighting.
Well, the Wall Street Journal has an interesting profile of Bradley Manning this morning. Talks about his hometown in Oklahoma, tries to tease out what his motivation might be. Do we think this is the guy, and could he have done it alone, Kevin, or do you think others are likely involved?
You know, I don't think we know. I think the suspicion has clearly fallen on him because of some of the other things that he's charged with doing, and it is certainly possible, given how essentially all of these documents were available on this top secret military, or sorry, not top secret, secret military website. It should be noted, none of these were at the top secret level. This was the secret level of classification, so it means it's much wider distribution. There are not always quite the level of security precautions that would prevent things like this.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll go to the phones in just a bit. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, Kevin Whitelaw. He's defense and foreign policy editor with Congressional Quarterly. Nancy Youssef, she's Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. And David Sanger, he's chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. We're going to go to the phone shortly, 1-800-433-8850. But first, I want to talk about the report coming out today by the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. Boy, this is filled with news that's just going to enrage a lot of Americans, I think. Kevin, tell us about it.
Well, one of the most interesting findings in it is that the Pentagon failed to account and is still unable now to account for more than $8 billion of Iraqi reconstruction funds that it was charged with dealing with. And this was not actually U.S. tax dollars. It was Iraqi money for the most part from sales of oil, from UN oil for the UN Oil for Food program, from some sale of frozen Iraqi assets and a number of other things. And so this was money spent early on in the effort to rebuild Iraq. But it was accounted for so badly that they literally have no idea what happened to billions of dollars. The Pentagon has no records about that.
Now, unaccounted for, does that mean it's probably been used fraudulently, David?
You know, it's hard to tell. You know, as Donald Rumsfeld famously said in another context in Iraq, when he was talking about the looting of buildings, stuff happens in a war zone. And one of the pieces of stuff that happens is that billions of dollars get siphoned off, some of it in corruption, some of it probably in bad record keeping. So I think that out of that 8 billion number, we may never know how much of it disappeared into somebody's pocket, which, you know, would not be uncommon in Iraq or Afghanistan, and how much of it was just the fact that nobody was used to serious accounting.
But, you know, it's certainly true that when you have an enterprise like this, some of the money's going to be unaccounted for. But the proportion of money that's unaccounted for seems quite extraordinary. And there was a report, in 2005, that raised these same issues, raised these same problems, but apparently didn't get the attention it deserved, Nancy.
And by the way, this was Reconstruction money in a country that still doesn't have electricity with any sort of reliable level. It still doesn't have water levels at what it needs. There are still basic infrastructure problems in Iraq. And so when Iraqis hear that $9 billion disappeared while they're still living on generators and struggling to keep their electricity, I think it's just all the more outrageous to them. And we've heard from Iraqis say, we want that money back. But because they say it's their money. And I think that just adds insult to injury to an Iraqi.
Also, they walk down the streets of some of the tonier neighborhoods in Baghdad, and they see some pretty fabulous houses these days. And it leads people to draw connections, rightly or wrongly, about what happened to some of that money.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the outrage here definitely is on the Iraqi side, because it really was their money one way or the other. This all came from Iraq. This is all separate from the money that Congress appropriated, which went through different channels and where the controls were a lot stricter. And you know, that can all be, you know, basically all be traced. But this was about about $9.5 billion. So almost all of this money, as you said, it's the proportion of it that also is amazing. Almost all of it, there was simply no record keeping. And what happened was the Pentagon simply didn't use the kinds of accounting methods that they actually were required to by law when they spend non-U.S. funds. There's all these different laws they're supposed to follow about this and procedures, and they just apparently didn't follow any of these.
Do we think they're going to start following them now?
Well, I don't know that there's any more Iraqi money that the Pentagon is charged with spending. So I'm not sure the situation in this case applies. A lot of this happened in the very early years. This happened sort of almost under the CPA, which, if you'll recall, the Coalition Provisional Authority was set up as a sort of ad hoc administrative body. And there have been a lot of issues about mismanagement of funds under that organization. This is part of that.
David Sanger, the U.S. and South Korea wrapped up their four-day war games in the Sea of Japan on Wednesday. What was the point of this exercise?
Well, the point of this exercise, if you believe the American and South Korean accounts, was to begin to create some greater level of deterrence for the North Koreans. It was prompted, of course, by the sinking of the Chinon, a small South Korean frigate that a South Korean investigation that was aided by the United States and others concluded was sunk by two North Korean submarines, one of which seemed to have fired a torpedo. This led to months of wrangling over whether there would be a UN resolution condemning North Korea. And in the end, there was a president's statement from the Security Council that was missing two things: any direct reference to North Korea and any reference to the fact that this ship was sunk in an attack. The White House immediately declared a great victory, saying North Korea had been set back by this. The Chinese and the North Koreans had a different view. The Chinese helped North Korea water down that resolution. Since that was so watered down, it became necessary for the U.S. and South Korea to do something else to express their displeasure. And that something else was this set of military exercises. But in the end, 5 months after this initial sinking happened, I think it's fair to ask the question, did the North Koreans end up paying a price for an act of aggression that appears to have killed 42 people, if you believe the North Koreans did it? And there really aren't many other plausible suspects out there. And I think the answer to that is no, they haven't paid much of a price.
And Nancy, what other recourse do the United States and South Korea have to make North Korea pay a price? I suppose one reason would be to try to prevent this kind of thing from happening again.
Well, that's precisely the problem, right? It's the limited options. Today, there's meetings going on at the United Nations, a third round of talks to try to hold for the world community to try to hold North Korea accountable in some way. Those talks are ongoing as we speak, and we'll see if that leads to an outcome that goes beyond this exercise. But David's right. I mean, it's limited with what the response can be. And so far, I think it's a very legitimate argument to say that they may have gotten away with it in a sense.
And when we talk about the Koreas, China always an important player. What has been their reaction and their role here, Kevin?
Well, you know, in the end, they're about the only country left right now that can actually put any real pressure on North Korea. And therein lies the problem. The Chinese were the ones who watered down and the resolution, blocked any firmer action at the UN. And they're the ones who still maintain basically some of the only remaining economic levers over that regime. And while there are some signs that the Chinese are getting at various points a little fed up with some of the North Korean regime's actions, they're still not willing to be out there publicly criticizing it, and they are, you know, not taking terribly strong steps, and it's not clear that that's going to change anytime soon.
Let me add something to what Kevin's pointed out. I think you could argue that the Chinese are actually being less activist against North Korea than they were a year ago. You'll remember that last year the North Koreans set off a nuclear test. That was their greeting to President Obama's inauguration. Some people send postcards. They sent off a nuclear test. And they also did some missile tests. In that case, the Chinese voted for a very tough resolution that actually imposed serious economic sanctions and allowed the inspection of cargo going in and out of North Korea once it arrived in different ports. Why did they act so strongly there and not here? I think two reasons. One is there was no question who did the nuclear tests. The North Koreans boasted about it. It was visible from every satellite. Not quite the case with the sinking of the Cheonan. But secondly, there is now a serious succession crisis underway in North Korea. The third son of Kim Jong-il appears likely to be designated in September as the heir apparent. There's a lot of turmoil there, and the Chinese are in the position of wanting to be able to reinsert some kind of influence. And I think they've concluded the best way to do that is to side with the North Koreans.
We may see a secession issue in North Korea. We saw the South Korea president resign yesterday, Nancy, but really not related to this dispute.
The prime minister.
The prime minister, yes.
That's right. That's right.
What was the issue there? Have I stumped the
panel? It was a domestic politics scandal that he got caught up in. So it was unrelated to this. But the South Koreans are in a difficult position. They are caught trying to find ways to put pressure on North Korea, and without totally losing the various efforts that have been made in recent years to do some effort of reconciliation, and that does still get caught up in this.
Right. Susan, in my days in South Korea, people used to explain to me that the president was elected of South Korea to run the country, and the prime minister was appointed to have someone who could resign when there was a problem. And I think that's what you saw happen.
Well, let's go to the phones and invite our listeners to join our conversation. David is calling us from Salt Lake City. David, thank you for holding on.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to revisit the discussion of the leaked documents, where it seemed like the panelists were saying that there really wasn't much that we had learned. And I wanted to know whether they thought maybe this sort of brought to mind in the American public's eye the extent of the disarray of the war effort, and whether it, in fact, in that sense, it seemed reminiscent of the Vietnam War, and it becomes difficult to imagine what a U.S. concept of a victory is, given these sort of on-the-ground reports.
And David, is this what struck you when you read about these documents?
Well, we learned about, mistaken civilian, attacks on civilians where they thought they were hunting out some Al-Qaeda operative or something like this. We learn about the sort of partial efforts in pacification or appeasement of local people that aren't followed through. And I think that really does come across.
You know, it is true that sometimes reports like this, even if they're not big new disclosures, they kind of crystallize people's views that, gee, this is a war that perhaps we can't win. Do you think that could happen here, David?
That certainly could, because the country was predisposed to the thought here already that
not only is there no real definition of victory in a war like Afghanistan, but President Obama has changed the American goals. He's scaled them back a lot. You don't hear him talking about bringing democracy to Afghanistan the way President Bush did. You don't hear him talking about nation building, even though the United States is doing a fair bit of that. But I'd also suspect that if we had similar reports from World War II or World War I or the Korean War, places where the mission was very clear and the definition of victory was relatively clear, my guess is you'd see a similar amount of chaos and civilians caught in crossfire and confusion and cursing about the Allies and so forth.
Nancy.
It's funny you mention that the president has scaled down his objectives in Afghanistan because he's increased the number of troops by 250% while he's done so. And I think that's the conflict that a lot of Americans are having, that we're investing more in treasure and yet scaling down what we can hope for success. And on a month, by the way, where we've just hit the record casualty figures. Today we're at 63, which makes this the deadliest month of a 9-year war. The second deadliest month was last month at 60.
Is that likely to continue, Kevin, these higher death tolls?
Well, you know, every time that this happened in Iraq and it's happening now, when the U.S. puts more troops in, they say they're going to take more more offensive measures. They're switching to a more active counterinsurgency set of tactics away from more of a counterterrorism effort. That means more troops are going out in the field. They're going out in operations. That puts them at risk, which is why one of the reasons we're seeing these higher casualty numbers.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Marie. Marie, thank you for calling us. She's calling us from Rochester, New York.
Thank you. I am appalled at the media that they should be determining what is important and that your actions have upset an extraordinarily delicate diplomacy in place and also then, and most importantly, place people at risk.
And so, Marie, when these documents are posted on WikiLeaks, what do you think the press should have done about that?
Keep them. They were gossip. They were basically gossip. They were an accumulation of somebody's diary, basically, intelligence diaries. They were not corroborated. They were not vetted. They were not top secret. And there's a reason for that.
All right, Marie. Thanks very much for your call. David, how would you react?
You know, I agree that these reports were fragmentary, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are journalistically not valuable. In fact, what we did was spend more than a month going through them, trying to compare them to reports that we had elsewhere, reports that we had published, trying to figure out if they offered us a different view or a reinforcing view of events that we already knew about or had other evidence of. So taken as raw material, I would agree with your reporter, with your caller. Our reporters did not take it as raw material. They wove it together and did what good reporters do, which is you throw out what there isn't evidence of, you throw out things that could cause operational harm to people, and instead you try to weave the most intelligent story from it that you can.
And, you know, I understand Marie's point. We're glad that she called. But I wonder if the press avoids its responsibility if a massive material like that is posted on a website and you fail to try to take a look at it, put into context and perspective, give people a kind of roadmap to it.
And by the way, we do that in our jobs every single day on much smaller issues. On a press conference, what should we lead with? What should be in the fourth graph or the fifth graph? That's a judgment call we have to make every single day, because what we're vying for is, in some cases, just a few minutes of someone's time to let them know what's going on. And so I think what the New York Times and the Guardian and Der Spiegel faced was that challenge on a much larger scale. And I think Marie's frustration, I don't know, and I don't want to conjecture, but I think it was the release of the names that I think for a lot of people, the Afghan names in particular, that sort of made it turn a corner and where it went too far. And to make a distinction that David made earlier and I think worth repeating, the newspapers didn't publish those names. WikiLeaks did.
You know, my colleague Pete Eisler interviewed Daniel Ellsberg on Monday, the person who leaked the Pentagon Papers, and he made the case that this was much less carefully vetted than the Pentagon Papers, that it had, you know, because of the massive material and the way in which it was posted, it was much riskier to U.S. interests than what he said, than what he had done in 1971.
Well, you know, this site, WikiLeaks, is not a journalistic outfit, and it does not really portend to be as such. It's a more of an activist thing, and they have a particular mission and a philosophy, and I don't know of any journalistic outfit in this country, at least, that would have done the same thing. That doesn't mean that you know, if those documents have been handed over to one of us, we would have done a very similar thing to what, you know, we would have done exactly what the New York Times did, publish selected excerpts. And there's actually a history of publications doing that. And absolutely, dumping 75,000 documents out there, there's no way they read every single one of them.
Kevin Whitelaw, he's defense and foreign policy editor at Congressional Quarterly. And with me in the studio for this hour, David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, and Nancy Youssef, she's Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about what's happening in Russia with the broadening of authority for the Federal Security Service that used to be called the KGB. And we'll take your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we add one more tribute to Daniel Schorr, who continued to be an NPR news analyst until a few weeks before his death last week. We'll listen back to the interview we recorded in 1994 on the 20th anniversary of Nixon's resignation. We talked about Schorr's CBS coverage of Watergate and his run-ins with CBS and the Nixon administration. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Getting lots of emails on the WikiLeaks story. So before we talk about Russia, let me just read two of them. Jonathan in D.C. sent us an email saying, has anyone questioned why so many of the WikiLeaked documents were classified secret in the first place? And Chet, who writes us from Richardson, Texas, says, we have heard in the last several years about how information has become secret that perhaps isn't necessarily that secret. Could there be a review of what really should be secret or not? So were these legitimately classified secret documents, Kevin?
Well, they were from the military's perspective because these were raw, uncorroborated intelligence reports from the field that in some cases contained names of sources and descriptions of methods used to gather intelligence. Having said that, it's also remarkable when you look at them, the vast majority of them were completely banal and didn't have a lot of information in them. And so I do think the government does suffer a little bit from, you know, in trying to make the case that this was a very dangerous disclosure, because on a casual perusal, they can look pretty harmless. But when they are released unsystematically like this without a review, that's where dangerous information that should remain secret does end up getting disclosed.
David.
Yeah, there's no question that anything with source material names and so forth should have been classified. Some of it probably should have been classified at a higher level than it was. There's also no question that the vast majority of what was in this this trove, this archive, was probably overclassified. And that's the major problem that you run into in classification and government today, which is if you stamp secret on everything, it's like stamping secret on nothing. Because there comes to be a sense that because it's so overclassified, there's no reason to particularly enforce the rules. And, you know, there was no greater advocate of this than Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the senator from New York, who wrote a fabulous book about over-classification. I think the book was published probably about 15 years ago, and the problem, if anything, has gotten worse. In fact, there are moments when things finally get declassified 40 or 50 years later. You open up the file, and what do you discover? Newspaper articles, you know, from the New York Times and other places that were thrown in the file and stamped secret because they were thrown in the file.
Nancy.
You know, Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, made mention of this yesterday at a press conference that, in fact, things in this town are overclassified. And yet, because of this leak, we might start to see that problem get even worse as there's a worry that documents will be leaked to places like WikiLeaks. So it's an interesting paradox.
Russia's president has broadened the authority of the Federal Security Service, which is not a familiar name to most Americans, but this is a successor agency to the KGB. What are these expanded authorities, Kevin?
Well, a lot of it is about is extra powers to go after to detain people, to question people, and seize various kinds of documents. This is an organization that still is obviously involved in not just investigations of criminals, but has a political component to it as well. So while the reason for doing this was said to be to go after criminals, there's a real suspicion that what the Russian authorities are trying to do is to shore up what they might seem to feel is an increasingly weak political position.
Here's an email that we've gotten on this subject, and this person writes, "Can your panel comment? Putin has recast or rebirthed a KGB-like entity. Does anyone think that the dark days of KGB versus CIA are returning? Will we see dissidents versus an oppressive regime again? Will a U.S. politician claim the evil empire has returned?" This emailer says, calls this very disheartening. David?
You know, if that does happen, and it may, but I would doubt it, it's more likely to happen with China than with Russia, because there is much more of a sense now of both economic and to some degree military competition with China than there is with Russia. That said, clearly Prime Minister Putin, President Medvedev, are reestablishing some levels of central control. For Mr. Putin in particular, a former KGB agent himself, there is no doubt that that's the direction he wants to head. And, you know, it's pretty remarkable that these guys got greater power after what was probably one of the most flubbed operations of modern times, which was these sleeper agents all around the U.S. who thought that they were learning deep secrets about the United States, not from WikiLeaks, but from living in Montclair, New Jersey. And, you know, the fact that a operation was sent out in such an unfocused and undisciplined way would make you wonder whether what's really happening is Russia is the same question that we ask here sometimes as well, which is there something that's gone slightly awry in the intelligence community?
You know, in that Russian spy case, it seemed so absurd that I wondered if there was some backstory that we weren't being told or some aspect of it.
You got to hope so.
Yeah. For the Russians,
yeah, right.
From the Russian point of view. Meanwhile, we see the Russian government approving a plan to sell off a lot of state properties. Why are they doing this, Nancy?
Well, I think it's a financial effort as much as anything else. And I think I think, frankly, you could say it as simply as that. It's a financial effort in a country that's struggling economically.
Let's go back to the phones, talk to Nika. She's calling us from Indianapolis. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I had a question in regards to the Chunan incident. And my mother actually recently got back from a trip from Korea, and she told us that the general public seems to think that there's some conspiracy theory going on between the U.S. and South Korea in regards to the sinking of the Chunan, and they think that The U.S. and South Korea plotted to sink the Cheonan and blame it on North Korea, and I was just wondering why they would think that. I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay, Nika, thanks very much for giving us a call.
Well, that's right. There is a big set of conspiracy theorists underway in South Korea. This is sort of the equivalent of the groups in the United States that believe the U.S. government plotted 9/11. But in this case, the South Korean government has made the problem a little bit worse themselves by conducting a lengthy investigation and then refusing to make public the report or the intelligence reports that indicate that these two North Korean submarines mysteriously left a port and appear to have been in the waters near there. They've announced the conclusions, but not a lot of the underlying evidence. And as soon as you do that, especially in a case like this where no one saw the torpedo get shot off, it lends itself to many such stories.
Paul has sent us a question on Facebook. He writes, on the North Korean sinking a South Korean ship, we're still technically at war with North Korea and an ally of South Korea, and the North Korean action is an act of war. So why don't we sink one of North Korea's subs?
Well, there's a pretty easy answer. We don't want to start World War III. That really would be an incredibly dangerous war to fight, given the size of the North Korean army. It's just something that it's a place that nobody wants to go. And so that's one of the reasons this was actually such a dangerous incident was it actually, you know, could technically be construed as an act of war, a continued act of war, and there might have been, with rights to retaliate, that would have quickly escalated beyond anyone's control.
We've seen tension between Venezuela and Colombia for some time, really becoming more serious, it seemed, this week. Nancy?
That's right. It was sort of kicked off, this latest round, if you will, by Colombian President Uribe, who charged the Venezuelan government with harboring 1,500 Colombian guerrilla fighters, and Hugo Chavez, being Hugo Chavez, immediately broke diplomatic ties with Colombia, and he threatened to cut off Venezuela's oil exports to the United States or anyone else who might be aligned with Colombia. And there are sort of two reasons or theories as to why it's gotten to this level. Remember, on August 7th, Colombia will have a new president, President-elect Juan Manuel Santos takes over at that time. And some people think that one, Uribe is trying to kind of clean up loose ends before he leaves government. And the other is that Uribe is trying to create a mess for his successor as he comes in. And so at the end of the day, I think that this will calm down on its own accord for now, but that this issue won't be over totally.
Does Colombia have a case? Do you think they make a convincing case that Venezuela is in fact harboring these rebels?
Well, there have been reports for a long time of Venezuela giving some aid to the FARC rebels, but you know the evidence has always been somewhat circumstantial. It's a little bit like trying to sort out, you know, how the Taliban and Al Qaeda may differ or support each other.
Now, we had a meeting about this, or there was a meeting about this that Ecuador called, by a group called the Union of South American States, which I had not actually heard of before. This is a new alliance of South American countries.
That's right, and that's where this came up. It's actually 34 states that are a member of this, and this was sort of the forum for this latest round to sort of be kicked off. And I think it was an effort to give legitimacy to the Colombian argument. And it was also a platform for Chavez to then start the discussions of cutting off diplomatic ties, perhaps in an effort to divert attention from the very, very real possibility, in fact, that they may be harboring these guerrillas.
Well, and as you can imagine, this very, very quickly gets caught up in people taking sides. Colombia obviously being a very, very strong U.S. ally, and Hugo Chavez being a very, very polarizing figure on throughout the continent. And so, this is one of those where very quickly countries line up on sort of one side or the other. One of the many reasons that this particular summit didn't actually seem to have achieved all that much.
You know, there was an interesting editorial, I thought, in the Washington Post this morning on this case. It said that this was a problem that, were it occurring in the Middle East, would surely be before the UN Security Council. Is that right, David? If it was happening in a different part of the world, would this be something we would talk of at the beginning of the news roundup instead of toward the end?
Well, it might be. You know, people said the same thing about the sinking of the Cheonan, and it took it ended up taking months before the Security Council got there. But
there are certainly many around the world who believe that if you have a terror-related incident that doesn't happen to be in Afghanistan, Iraq, or somewhere around the Middle East, or against an established power like the United States or Britain, that it doesn't get the same attention.
Here's an emailer, Diane, from Intervale, New Hampshire, who writes, "The Maliki government in Baghdad, questionably elected, has still not resolved internecine issues between Shiites and Sunnis. Will this disarray have a negative impact on the proposed withdrawal of U.S. troops?" Nancy, what do you think?
The simple answer is no, because the United States is determined to get out on the schedule that it's agreed to, no matter what. Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was in Baghdad this week, and he reiterated that message. And this comes at a time not only when there is no government, but when al-Qaeda is trying to reconstitute itself and when there's no reconciliation happening. And that's a trifecta of instability in Iraq. And yet the United States has said that they're leaving. The United States is determined to be down to 50,000 troops by the end of the summer.
Could anything disrupt that, or is that a course that is pretty much set in stone?
You know, I asked Raymond Odierno, who's the current commander there, the 50,000, I think, is determined. But at 50,000, at what level would the United States get involved if there's an outbreak of violence? And his answer to me was, "I don't know," which I took as code for nothing. And remember, the United States is plussing up in Afghanistan is dependent on getting those troops out in Iraq. You've got a United States Army that's been in persistent conflict now for 9 years. It's exhausted. It's really planned. It's resetting based on this withdrawal date. And I think there's a political reality. This administration doesn't want to be entangled in two wars. As it is, it's already set a deadline for trying to get out of the second one.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You know, you've raised the issue of the planned beginning of withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan just a year away. But I wondered, do you feel that that's as firmly set as the withdrawal that's been promised in Iraq? David?
No, it's not. You know, it's clear that starting in July of 2011, there will be some kind of withdrawal. But whether that will be a substantial withdrawal, as you've heard from Vice President Biden, or whether it may be a modest conditions-based withdrawal, as you've heard from the Defense Secretary Robert Gates, is still unclear. And that's why you have seen this sort of strange set of events this summer, where the debate on this issue, which President Obama hoped would be delayed until next summer, has actually taken place a year early. You know, it took a long time for the House to approve the additional wartime funding. And when they did, not many more than 100 Democrats voted for it. It really required the Republican votes to get that through. What that tells you is that the erosion of support for the president's strategy is happening a lot faster than he thought it would when he announced it last December 1st.
Nancy?
I think the other thing that's triggering this conversation was that 45-minute meeting that happened between General Petraeus and President Obama on the day that General McChrystal was relieved of his duty as Afghanistan commander. And I can't help but wonder what General Petraeus said about that deadline. Look, I don't know of a counterinsurgency that has been won with a deadline looming over it. And you can't help but wonder, what did General Petraeus say? At the minimum, Biden's rhetoric about how you're going to see a rush of troops leaving the door, it really subsided after that day. And I can't help but wonder if maybe Petraeus had a say and said, look, any withdrawal is going to be conditions-based.
And, of course, General Petraeus has enormous credibility in this country with the Congress, even with the American public. So he would be in a position to say, we can't do this if he wanted to.
That's actually one of the most interesting things to watch, I think, down the line is if the U.S. military becomes very concerned about the trend line and say that they're going to need more troops for a longer period of time, and Petraeus decides to make a stand on that could put President Obama in a very, very, very difficult position, particularly with the erosion of political support he's seeing within his own party. It could be a very, very complex problem for him.
Nancy?
I just want to add one thing. We saw General Mattis, James Mattis, the Marine Corps Commandant, who's the nominee to be the CENTCOM commander. And during this testimony, nobody asked him about his qualifications, how he felt about counterinsurgency. They all asked basic questions about the United States strategy in Afghanistan. What does the end state look like? We're at a point now where we're beefing up the number of troops we have there. And on Capitol Hill, very basic questions are being asked about what the U.S. objectives are in Afghanistan.
David, we'll give you the last word.
You know, I think that what we're forgetting in this whole debate is that in the end, Afghanistan is an action intended to keep al-Qaeda from coming back in as a safe haven. And the problem, and the strategic problem for the U.S., is in Pakistan. And whenever you ask the question, why are we really in Afghanistan, the honest answer comes back to keep the pressure on to go after al-Qaeda in Pakistan. I'm not sure in this debate that we've heard so far that anyone's really attacked that central issue.
You know, we've gotten a huge number of emails and calls still on this WikiLeaks case. So I'll close with just two contrasting emails. One from Kevin in New Mexico writes, WikiLeaks and their sources are heroes in this era of endless war and excessive secrecy. And then this one from William, who writes us from Florida. The founder of WikiLeaks is holding himself up as a hero of journalism. To me, he would be more of a hero if he were to document exactly how our enemy plans suicide attacks. Well, I want to thank David Sanger, Nancy Youssef, and Kevin Whitelaw for joining us this hour on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.